Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast. Yes, back for another episode of the show. I'm your host, Andy Austin, and this time out, it is stage number one with one of the most visible characters in main racing the last two, 3 decades. Because whether it was mainly motorsports, the race in preview, the Augusta show, I mean, basically for years, he kept our off seasons extremely busy and engaged, too. And of course, you throw in mainly trophies, car ownership, lawnmower racing, which of all the things that we talked about, just on a selfish note, the one time I did do lawnmower racing, it was actually on Steve Perry's lawnmower. So lawnmower racing, all sorts of stuff he finds himself in. He's a great dude. He's Steve Perry, and he's going to be on not only this episode, but it's a multi-episode series. I want to thank you for all your support with the Lewis Anderson episodes. Lots of awesome feedback on those. Thank you again for sharing, screenshotting, you know, all the S words. Share, screenshot, 5-star review. Okay, so there's an F word in there, but, you know, 5-star reviews, just a little inside baseball stuff. And if you have a podcast, you know what I'm talking about. The way the algorithm works is they love to feed you things that look successful. Right. So if you give us a 1-star review, that doesn't help. You know what I mean? It basically think of it as a 1-star review is going to the tail end of the longest line, or being held 15 seconds for a pit stop, or having to add lead to your car. You know, that's no fun. So 5-star reviews, that basically means we're track favorites and we get to the front of the line. So the more of those, the more we're track favorites. And who doesn't want to be the track favorite, at least on the inside? So anyway, thanks a lot for all of that. Patreon.com/OpenTrailerPodcast. If you want to contribute to this show, you'll get an early drop, which happens on Tuesdays. And of course, you know, we're working on some other stuff too. If you want some merch, I don't have much of it because we're pretty dry on it, but going to do a new run for the new year and certainly hook you up there. So if you've known Steve the last couple of years, then, well, you know all the things I've already spoken about in this introduction. And one of the reasons why I wanted to have him on is because even before all that, he had such an amazing story, being a driver, being a car owner, and some of the cool things that happened to him in the 80s and 90s and even before that. So let's learn a little bit and let's learn a lot about Steve Perry on Open Trailer Podcast. I think your public history goes back probably 20, 25 years, but your history at Beechridge goes back a lot longer. How many people remember you as a driver?
David Oliver does.
Yeah.
Well, because whenever one of my cars shows up, he always makes a comment on Facebook, particularly, of one of my particular cars that he always one of his favorite cars, and yeah. He always used to say that I was one of his favorite drivers. So whether he forgets that I'm not on TV anymore and he doesn't need to do it to try to get himself some TV time, you know, I didn't have that illustrious career as a driver. You know, if I raced 110 races, let's say, as a limited sportsman driver, I would probably say I went home 15 out of 110 nights, what I called a successful night.
Really?
Yeah, 95 nights were failures.
How many times did you win?
I won one main event.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was pretty funny. Everything lined up. You know, right. It was one of those races where the car was going good. It was my second year.
How many cars in the limited sportsman at this point?
At that time,
yeah,
there was probably 70. You know, so they were running the creature feature. You had to qualify.
Yeah.
There was a Conti. There was a chance that all the top dogs weren't going to be in the race. You started up front. You started wherever. And, you know, at the end, usually the top guys always got there. Just like today, so to speak.
Right.
So, you know, that night, you know, I was doing battle. And earlier in the year, I had a chance to win on one of those days where they just drew A and B features. And it was because the ACT Tour was in town. And It was my first time. It was like my second or third week. I had just bought David Pinkham's championship car from the year before.
The one that Alan Berry built?
Yep. So,
oh, wow.
It was. I had a good race car because I didn't have a good race car before. So the car was way better than the driver. So had I known how to drive, I probably would have won.
Yeah.
We heard Louis talk about that, you know, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
He didn't know how to drive. He had a car that he didn't know how to drive. I was that same person. I couldn't pass Ed Gallant. I didn't know how to.
Smiling, I didn't know how to pass him.
Yeah. The car was way better. So now here we are, two thirds of the way, three quarters of the way through the season. I got a good car, but now I'm much better at being able to drive. And so the race is going on, and I get to second, and Steve Winslow is leading the race, and I'm able to get around him and pass him, and then I'm starting to check out, and it's kind of funny. So now, you know, you hear guys talk about it. You know, you start hearing things, you start feeling things, and, you know, my stomach's churning, you know. You could potentially win a race.
Yeah.
You know, get interviewed on the front stretch. This is something.
How big of a deal is that? I mean, a lot of people talk about it, but I mean, you seem pretty authentic in saying that's what I'm looking forward
to. I don't think people understand sometimes, you know, and I was a big advocate of this for years. And I used to say, like, Beechridge was one of the last places to introduce the top three guys getting interviewed. And I used to say to people all the time, why aren't they doing that? Because that guy might finish third once in his career. Once. And do they not understand how big of a deal that is for that one night, for his family to see and witness what that feels? So I had that one night where I got to be interviewed and got to look up in the crowd and got to hear my mother on the fence, and you know what I mean? And, you know, and we talk about it. Me and Debbie talk about it all the time.
Mm.
Some people just take that for granted, you know, because it happens to them all the time. But the people that don't get those opportunities, and I think back to the night, and I listened in Louis' podcast, the night he won, and you heard him talk about
when everybody congratulated
how much I played a role in
his
taking that next step into the racing. So I was standing on the fence, and I played a role into getting him to have a car capable of winning. So he's trying to wave me down that night to come down into Victory Lane to have his picture. I want no part of it. That's not why I'm there.
Yeah.
So when I go over into the pits after, and he's like, I wanted you to come down and have your picture. I said, Louis, what this night was about to me was your girls have sat in that spot for how long and watched how many other kids get to go down that night or at nights and watch other kids have their pictures taken with their dads or their grandfathers or whoever. Tonight it was about your kids getting that opportunity.
Yeah.
That's what it meant to me. You know what I mean? So that night back in 1988, was my chance to, you know what I mean? So it was a big deal, and it never came again. I won a couple creature features and stuff, but, you know, I can always say that I won a race, you know? Yeah.
So 88, I mean, it sounds like, you know, obviously that meant a lot to you more than, say, someone who just kind of came into the racetrack and, you know, raced a few times. So that tells me that you are a Beechridge lifer.
Yeah.
I mean, when, how far back do you go in racing, as far as your racing experience as a race fan? What got you into it?
71 was when I first went there. I was 5 years old. My mother's husband at the time, Larry Ramsey, which is Brick's dad, he worked on a car that Larry Chandler drove, the old C-Class, and then he decided he was going to make his forte into the D-Class. So, you know, we went every single week. You know, every single week. We would we were there, you know, we were one of the first ones in line, you know, we would sit in the, you know, bring our lunch, and it just, you know, I think back to those days, and I think all the time when, you know, obviously never going to happen again, but even going to any racetrack, and I think back, and I look at the fans today, and they don't realize what they don't get to experience, what we got to experience back then. You know what I mean?
Who were some of the people that you really looked up to? Who did you gravitate towards besides Larry?
Well, I didn't gravitate towards Larry. You know, I mean, you're supposed to because it's your stepdad and all that.
Yeah, it's like Lewis didn't even watch his dad race.
Yeah, no. So Larry raced, but I mean, I guess he called it racing, but he didn't. Right. And it was so funny because you know, everybody back then had the knitted sweaters. Everybody wore the knitted sweaters, And we all had them. And by lap two of the feature, I would take mine off because wherever he started, he was last. You know what I mean? And we used to sit diagonally from the Kudamashes.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not stand Ralph Cusack.
Really?
And it had everything to do with they won. They got to experience that feeling that I always wanted to experience.
Yeah.
Like, I never got to walk out of there any night as my dad or stepdad or whoever won. We never got to experience that feeling.
Did you guys run the same class?
No.
So it didn't even matter.
Didn't even matter. But you know what I mean? But that that feeling. Like, they got to experience that. They got to cheer. They got to, you know what I mean? And I never got that feeling. I just... You know, I'd peel my sweater off at lap two or three. And
a little bit of shame.
Yeah, a little bit of shame. You know, I don't even know why we're doing this, you know? And but my first ever favorite driver was Charlie Small.
Really?
And the reason was because he had one of the Chevelle, the number 21.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell that, and this is, sounds stupid, he must have been eating the same cereal I was at the time because... The cereal had those stickers, like the car stickers, the Zoom ones or the whatever they were. And it was given out like three stickers in the box every time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he decorated his fenders with.
The Cheerios?
And I decorated my bikes with. And
what was your cereal of choice back in the day?
Count Chocula.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that was, he was my first real favorite driver. And but then I realized... your favorite driver is supposed to win.
Yeah.
And Charlie didn't win much. So then I gravitated to Homa. Really? You know what I mean?
So you're a Homa guy.
Yeah. And it just, you know, it just, you want your guy to win, you know? And so I gravitated to Homa.
So that's 71. When do you start getting involved with crewing? Like, what's the next step for you?
Well, it's funny because I moved to South Portland with my dad. I get into a demolition derby, you know, make some money there. I'm like, wow, this is...
Wait a minute, your idea of making money in racing is a demolition derby?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll go with that.
Met my first wife because of it, because it was kind of funny is, you know, I was 16 years old. They had like 120-something cars.
Yeah.
So they split you up in heats. I win my heat. You know, I think some of the people shut their cars off to save them for the feature, but I'm 16 years old.
Yeah.
You know.
All guns blazing. You're at the racetrack.
Brass balls. I'm going. I keep it running. And so they get, you know, they stop it and they come down to interview the news channel. They want to interview this 16-year-old kid that is the last car running.
Mainstream news, like 6, 8,
yeah,
or 13?
13, one of those, yeah.
Wow.
So... That next Tuesday night at roller skating, these two girls come over and start talking to me. They're like, hey, we saw you on the news Monday night.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And like, hey, you know, you were at the, you know, well, that.
You were the guy on the racetrack.
Yeah, because we were there and you know, blah, blah, blah. And we were cheering for you because you hang out the street. So lo and behold, you know.
So they've been checking you out anyway.
Oh, yeah.
This was just the,
this was the introduction. Yeah. So 1984. I believe it was the spring of 85. I get an enduro.
Yeah.
Same thing. Finish fifth, make money. So I'm like, this racing thing's pretty cool.
Yeah. Everybody makes money.
Oh, yeah. Then I realized how to be dumb in racing.
Yeah.
Go racing.
Oh. You know?
So I decide I'm going to build a limited and we're going to go racing the next year, you know?
Wow.
So, you know, you can go buy a car and you can, you know, use your head and do it that way, you know, especially your first year. But no, I'm going to go build one. So we build a car. I work two jobs and I spent.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, like what? I want to go back to the school thing a little bit. I mean, you know, at 16 years old, you're winning these enduros. What kind of student are you?
When I realized that 69.5 was a D, that's the kind of student I was. I was,
yeah.
I didn't pay attention in school.
Were you the class clown?
Did you see my yearbook with the senior superlative?
I did not.
Yes, I was.
It does not surprise me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Class clown. Yep. Yeah. So always the life of the party. Always. I enjoy making people laugh.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, didn't really pay attention in school. Just wanted to enjoy life. And I do. I just enjoy life to its fullest. And so just really, I didn't have a focus in life. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And that was it.
Was there anything that you were interested in school? Like, well, some people gravitate, they suck in school, but they find mechanics work out for them. So you weren't a mechanic.
Nope.
But yet you're building your own race car.
Yeah, but I didn't. I mean, I had to have help because I didn't, I didn't. So, everybody thought, family included, that, I was generally lazy, not gonna do much, not gonna succeed, not gonna, Mm-hmm. So at, I just had turned 17. I was a junior. I guess I was 16. I was a junior in high school, getting ready for my senior year. I left living with my mom, moved with my dad. My dad, his girlfriend was 22. They had two young babies. So, mm-hmm. It was a definite change in life, it was like I died and gone to heaven because I'd gone to a house where I had discipline and structure to.
Yeah.
He had a 22-year-old wife with two kids, and he worked a lot. So I was basically.
You can fill in the blanks. Yeah.
On my own.
Yeah.
On my own.
And she was not. You were not her responsibility.
Yeah. And she was 6 years older than me. So yeah. Literally, I could come and go and literally handed the keys to the vault. And wow. So it was really the opportunity for me to fail. It everything was there for me to fail as an individual,
Yeah, you could have easily gone down the wrong road.
Yeah, easily.
Perceivedly. I think you're one of the least lazy people I know. But you're perceived lazy. You're a 69.5 student, and you have no direction.
Yeah.
And now you have the keys to the kingdom to party, host, be a goofball, do anything you want. What grounded you? What gave you direction?
Desire. Yeah. You know what I mean? I got a job.
Where'd you work?
A place called Sportsman's Grill.
Yeah.
It was my first, went to eat. The first week I moved in with my dad, he took me out to eat. He knew the manager there, told him I needed a job, hired me on the spot. Worked there, and then I haven't stopped since.
Yeah.
Just the desire and drive to just always want more, it hasn't always worked out and I've made a lot of poor decisions,
Right.
In business and in life, but I don't want to quit. I don't quit. I'm not out 8 years old mowing lawns like Mike Maeda. Yeah. I still would like to, if anybody's got a picture of Mike Maeda mowing a lawn at 8 years
doing
old.
Doing manual labor.
Yeah. Doing manual labor at 8 years old. I will gladly buy that picture.
Yeah.
But it's just, I don't know. I just, I've always wanted to, when my senior year of high school, I lived in South Portland, commuted to Bonnie Eagle every day. And work 40 hours a week. So yeah. I always want more. And sometimes I don't know how to get more, and I do stupid things, but I always want more.
I know you from, I don't know you from it, but I know the story of you working in the mill in Westbrook and just working shift after shift after shift after shift so you can go racing.
Yeah.
When did that start to kick in?
So, yeah, I'd worked in the restaurant business, and I'd worked in another place called Silvex, and then I got the opportunity to go to the mill. And, once you go to the mill, basically that's where you retire from. Yeah. Everybody goes to what they call Mother Warren, and then you retire from there, But things changed, They had, shut down big parts of it. And but I was there for 12 years making good money, So that allowed me to take some of that money and go to that next level. So the guy that was the limited sportsman driver that could now afford to maybe turn into a car owner and buy a super sportsman, which in turn would turn into what was the Pro Series, but at the time was the late model,
mm-hmm.
and maybe go beyond his means and become a car owner and go up against the Miettas and the Fowlers and all that. But the mill, I don't want to say afforded me or allowed me, but made me think I could.
Yeah. So I want to make sure I frame this question right. You know, when you say the Miettas and the Fowlers, those are the marquee teams of Beech Ridge. That's the royalty. And then you, continuing with our Lewis Anderson underdog story from last week or the last time out, almost seem like an underdog where you want to almost overcompensate or overperform so that you can compete with these people. Is that something that you felt to that drove you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's underdog or
you had something to prove.
You always think you got something to prove, you know? So, you know, when I got done, you know, I got married, you know, and just became a race fan. You know, just going to the races, you know, dropping the money at the front gate, going in and watching racing. You know, I'm not addicted, just watching racing.
not addicted.
Yeah. You know, got my friend, Danny Poulin, hanging out, coming every, he doesn't come every week, but he comes. And, you know, when we watching the Super Sportsman, we fall in love with that division. Ah, geez. And every week we're armchair quarterbacks. Oh, why are they doing this? And we could do this. And we should have one of these. And why don't we do this? And why don't we do that? And so I kept saying, let's do it. And then he'd back off. And he would talk again, and he'd back off. And finally I got tired of him bluffing. So finally I said, I'm going to go buy one. So I literally went and bought a car, and I said, we're going to go do this.
Who'd you get the car from?
I bought it from Gary Clough.
Okay.
It was a Dick Lyons car, and at the time, his cars were the best. It was Donnie Culper had one in the class. It was winning races, and so we had one, and we finished putting it together. We showed up about halfway through the, I want to say it was the 94 season.
Okay.
So first race in it, Danny, this is when you got to know that the guy really probably doesn't have the interest to go back racing. We worked. We got it ready. We're going to go down and, you know, it's our first race back.
Danny had raced in the modifieds for a long time.
Long time.
And probably to the, when the division dissolved in 90. And so he had taken a few years off too.
Yeah.
And then you pulled him back in, and you say that he didn't really have the desire.
Well, he thought he did. Yeah. Well, the first night back, we're ready to go racing. We get down there, me and longtime friend Steve Purvis, we pull the car down there and we get it all unloaded and stuff. And he's going to meet us there on his alley and getting ready for practice. And he's nowhere to be found. So we get Kerry Anderson. We're like, hey, Kerry, can you maybe take the car out, shake it down? And, you know, you know, we got to get some practice. So Kerry takes it out and it feels pretty good, you know. And we'll go out in the next practice and, you know, Danny can put some we'll put some tires on it. And second practice and
no Danny.
I'm like, we're trying to call him and like, where are you? You know, doesn't answer.
On a bag phone or something?
Doesn't answer.
Yeah.
Doesn't answer. Nope.
Wow.
So finally he shows up. I'm like, it's just a beautiful day. And me and Junior, we were on our bike, so we went down to the beach and, you know, so I'm like, yeah, maybe he doesn't have the interest to really race, you know? So,
or maybe he was just scared.
No, I don't think he was scared to come back. I just don't think he, you know, like, don't think he had the interest.
So, I would have told you at least that I don't have the interest.
Well, he did after a couple weeks. So, so we raced the first night, you know, just, you know, first night back, you know, not expecting much. We come back the second week, and he wins second week out.
Oh, wow.
So pretty impressive, you know, been out of a car 5 years, comes out the next week, wins, comes back the third week after starting on the tail, finishes third. So I'm like, that's pretty good.
So being a car owner is just pretty easy for you.
This is good.
Yeah.
Then he tells me he's all done. Like, this is too much work. I forgot how much work it is. I don't want to work on it. And so we'd made some decisions and put some other guys in the car. And at the end of the year, I drove the car a couple times and had some success. And the last race of the year was an ACT race. And I'd actually had a photo finish where they interviewed me and Kerry Martin.
Wow.
They didn't know who won it, you know? And it was that, and of anybody that drove the car that year, which was Donnie Culprit, Danny, and myself, I actually made it go the best of anybody. And so there was talk that I would run next year for Rookie of the Year in 1995, but I really had no interest. I enjoyed the car owner side of things.
What number was this car?
This was number 22.
Okay.
So then the next year, you know, I consulted with my buddy Perv, and we decided that we would stay as a car owner. I'd made a deal with Donnie Culprit that he would come and become our driver. So in 1995, I really took the car ownership side of things seriously, and we chased the Super Sportsman Championship, and we won it, you know, and that really propelled me into really becoming serious, and I don't want to say put us on the map, but like people like, oh, this, they're serious about this.
You know? Who's the first person that come over to you that you were surprised by to say, Steve, boy, you guys really have a good program here. Someone that you looked up to.
Spanky Anderson.
Really?
Because I had raced with him in the limited days, but I didn't know him, you know, because back then you had 70 or 80 competitors.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know them all. But he was always looked up. Everybody looked up to him because he always had the beautiful cars. He was always, everything was immaculate. So what impressed me was when, after 95, we decided we wanted to make the step up and I was going to go late model racing with Donnie. You know, we'd won the championship.
Yeah. So to explain to the audience that isn't, you know, wasn't around Beatridge, and that's now 30 years ago, too.
Jesus.
It went limited sportsmen, super sportsmen were eventually what the sports series became until the end of the track. And late model sportsmen was the top division.
The pro series.
The pro series. Super, the equivalent of super late models, just to kind of paint the picture for the steps that you were taking as a car owner. So yep. You want to go up to basically a super late model program, but the 90s version.
Yep. Yep. So I wanted to go to the pro series. Mm-hmm. And so Spanky, who was very well respected, you know, by a lot of people, wanted to become part of our program.
Really?
And that would be one of the things that we were lacking. Because, you know, when you see it all the time and you hear people when they talk about trying to be the crew chief from the driver's seat, and that's where we would have been with Donnie. So mm-hmm. Spanky coming on board and taking on that leadership crew chief role, that, you know, that showed that we had something that a guy like that, who had been with Kevin Durgan when Kevin had his success with the Super Sportsman and then was Cassett doing the double
dual. The seven car, yeah.
Yep, the seven car. So for him to, you know, step forward and want to be a part of our program at the level we were trying to get to, that made me say, maybe this is something worthy of, you know, when a guy
modern
like that,
day, that would be like, say, a Jason Ricker, who's worked for a ton of great teams. I know he works over at Oxford now, but basically he's been the hired gun, or a Seth Holbrook or someone come over and say, you know what, I have this experience, but I want to be part of your team.
Yep.
Just
yep.
To bring it up to modern day standards.
Yeah, no. So that was a big deal. So we did that, and we had a lot of success right out of the box. You know, the first year we won four races as rookies. 3 second place finishes, and everything else was you ended up on a ramp truck or a wrecker.
Yeah.
And, you know, the funny part was, you know, I had a team. And one thing as a car owner that I always instilled in with my guys is, you know, I'm just the car owner, okay? You guys are going to do your thing. I've always surrounded myself with good people and let them do their job. I don't micromanage. I don't, and we just have fun. And that's my job, is to make it fun.
Yeah.
And, so we had a great time, you know. I remember, you know, we had sponsors, and at the beginning of the year, I said, listen, I got a little bit of extra money that I wasn't thinking we'd have. We can do one of two things. I can buy season passes for you guys, and it was Spanky and Perv and Phil Doobie and, you know, guys that had a lot of experience.
Yeah.
Or I can set that aside, try to collect some more, and we can go to the Oxford 250. And they said, listen, we can all pay our own way in every week. Let's go to the Oxford 250.
And how much money are we talking?
$3,000. I mean, I to go to the 250 was going to be $3,000 to $5,000 back then. You know,
okay.
To do it right.
Right.
We're
going to
go and do it right. So,
in the 90s,
in
1996,
96.
96.
So
yeah.
We're going to go and do it right. You know, we need to pay everybody's way in, and we need to buy fuel, and we need to buy food, and we need to, you know, buy tires and practice tires. You know, and yeah, so we went to the Oxford 250 in 1996 as a rookie team from Beech Ridge Motor Speedway.
And what incarnation was the 250 at this point? Because it had moved on from NASCAR.
Yeah.
So I think Tom Curley had taken over it. So it probably wasn't. Was it an act sanction race?
Yeah, I don't know if it was act sanction, but it was the, you know, it was the late models. They called them late models and stuff.
It was still very much an open comp type race.
Open comp race, you know. And what people don't realize, this was the era, and I like to say, this was back in the day where they didn't give 10 or 15 spots away, but 10 or 15 spots were already taken. Okay, this was when you had the Nason era with the big motor cars, Mike Rowe, Dion, Nason, these Hanley, Whitlocks coming. So those guys were going to qualify no matter what. They drag raced down the straightaways, got through the corners, and drag raced down the next straightaway.
At Oxford, it's hard to drag.
And
anywhere.
they were bringing 90 plus cars back then, 90 plus cars, six heats, 16 cars to a heat. Taking 4 or 5 cars, you know?
Yep.
So it's a struggle, okay? So we're there as a rookie team.
Had you ever been to Oxford?
I'd been to not to run.
But did you have a notebook?
No notebook. I say that.
No.
We went up, and this is how, when I say I try to plan, you know? So this is how we look at the schedule. I said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go up on a Wednesday night. They have a Wednesday night program like 2 weeks before the 250. We're going to go up and run on a Wednesday as a test session. We buy a set of tires.
Mm-hmm.
We get a check back. So there's a little bit of money, but there's a practice set of tires. So at least we go up, we use it as a test session, and we get some practice tires. So it's kind of like a business decision.
Okay.
So Beech Ridge, race Friday, race Saturday. So we went up Friday morning, bought all our tires. Took a chance that we weren't going to get wrecked at Beech Ridge on Friday or Saturday. But that's the preparation you do.
Yeah.
If you want to be in this race, you do this.
You got to roll the dice.
Yeah. Beech Ridge was running Goodyears at the time. They were running McCreary's. Okay? So we go home after Beech Ridge on Saturday. Okay? We go back to the shop, put the car on the scales, and we work all night. Change the car over because the tires... We have a set of practice tires. We put them on our car. We can set the car up. We can move the weight around because they had different weights. So we're going up there prepared, okay?
Mm-hmm. How many guys are working on the car at this point, roughly?
We got 4 or 5 guys. We got our crew guys.
Okay.
They're working all night, okay? So we don't even have an enclosed trailer. We have an open trailer. We're hauling our first year at Beech Ridge. We're hauling to an open trailer.
Cool.
Tom Plant from Kenny Bunk Glass lets us borrow his trailer. And he hauls it up for us till we got an enclosed trailer, you know? So we work all night. We drive up there the next morning, you know, no sleep. We got all our tires. We got everything else. All the other teams that went up there that year from Beech Ridge, okay? I'm not saying all of them. We'd have to look at the starting lineup or the finishing lineup, right?
Mm-hmm.
They all went home and went to bed. They all came up the next day. Maeda, Johnson, Steve Howard.
They just figured they'd try
a few others.
Run the next day, yeah.
Showed up, took their Goodyears off, put their other tires on and all that. When the race rolled out, we were standing on the infield for the national anthem because we qualified. They didn't. And that all came from the preparation at the shop.
Yeah.
And we hear that all the time. And
races are won in the shop.
Yep. And it was so funny because after the draw, we had a bad draw, right?
I was going to ask you about that.
So... the driver comes back, and what does the driver do? He gets down on himself. I go, listen, we all get together.
Is that Donnie?
Donnie, yep. Yeah. And we start talking. I go, listen, fifth is first. Fifth is first. Get to fifth. That'll put your pole in the consi. You gotta. This is what we're racing for now. You gotta start thinking ahead.
It's like racing Tetris.
Yeah, you gotta start thinking ahead. You can't. You know, you can't take yourself out of the ball game right now, you know? So we got to that point, finished fifth, one spot out of qualifying. Puts us on the pole for the heat, for the consi. Starting behind us is Dave Dion, you know? So that's stressful in itself.
Yeah, because he had just won the race he'd run the race a couple times.
Yeah, a couple times.
85 and 95. So he was 92. Defending 92.
Yeah, 92.
Okay, yeah.
And so... we lead 20 laps of the consi, puts us in the show. You know what I mean? And, you know, so now we're in the show. Rookies. You know, wow. Rookie team.
That's unheard of.
Yeah, unheard of.
Yeah. How do you guys fare in the 250?
So, you think back to the 1996 250.
Trying to.
Larry Gelinas wins it, right?
Oh, that was that year? Okay, yep. Yeah. All right.
So, we race the whole first half of the race with Larry Gelinas and Benji Rowe. We race the whole race, the three of them, mm-hmm. all together. So, Donnie comes on the radio at probably lap 175 or something. And he says, I got a wicked vibration. And I said, how bad? He says, it feels like the motor's going to shake right out of the car. Mm-hmm. We're a local Saturday night team at Beechridge. We lose the motor, we're all done.
Yeah. And so, you're in the points race.
Yeah. Well, we're not really in the points race, but we're all done. You know what right. I mean? We're all done racing. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, but I'm saying for Beechridge,
we're not really, because we either wreck or win. Okay. You know what I mean? Yeah. So the crew, we're all talking as a group, and I'm like, we can't blow the motor up. You know what I mean? Because sometimes it depends on where you blow the motor up. Now you're out of snout, rear clip, whatever. Mm-hmm. Ruin other people's days too. So he's like, listen, I mean, I can't even hang on to it. This is really bad. So I said, well, you might as well pull it in. You know what I mean? No sense taking a chance of blowing the motor, you know? So he pulls off the two turn and pulls in the pits. At that point, Grimmie, and everybody knows Grimmie, comes running over. He's helping David Pinkham and them guys. So he comes running over. He goes, what's wrong? And so we got a wicked bad vibration. He goes, yeah, two laps ago we got out of the groove on the backstretch. He goes, I guarantee you he picked up rubber. Because that's what these tires do. They'll pick up rubber, and it'll take a couple laps to get rid of them. And I said, really? So I get on the radio to Donnie, who's in the pits now, in the backstretch, and he says, hey, start the car up. What's the motor sound like? He says, sounds fine and everything. I said, well, bring it back out. So we brought it back out. The vibration was gone, but once you go in the back pit, they pull your scorecard, so you're down laps. So who knows what would have been, but we were on the lead lap at like lap 175 of the 250 or whatever it was.
And that's the longest he's probably ran in his life as a
driver. Yeah, at that point, you know.
So, I mean, you guys have a lot of success that first year, but I'm sure, you know, as you say, you have kind of a more mentality. So that made you, I'm sure, want to go back year after year.
Yeah.
So that became a yearly thing for you guys.
So it's funny is, so we had a great first year at Beechridge, went in four races, won the last race of the year. The Prime Style 150, which was our fourth feature win in front of the Bush North crowd. So we're hungry. You know, we go back now. I remember having a conversation with Rex Garrett and Dickie Fowler, and I think Dickie and Mike won the championship. And Rex said, this is you guys' for the taking next year. You guys can break that Fowler, Maeda, Randall chain.
Yep.
So I said, we're going to give it everything we can. You know, we stripped the car, we did everything we could, and I kind of knew we had Beechridge against us. You know what I mean? And you know, you're trying
the hierarchy.
Yeah, you kind of try not to think that or talk about it, but just different things. You know, from going to the mall show that year when. You remember back the mall shows, and they kind of, all right, we can only take so many cars, and you know, we do it by like a point lineup. Okay. So you guys finished seventh in points or whatever it is, so you know, you might not get into the show. But we also have stipulations, like where we, if you're a former champion or something. Okay. So.
Yeah.
We found out like the day before we were getting to go into the main mall, like we had the car already. Then they finally tell us somebody backed out and you're getting to go into the mall. And I said, okay. But then when I ask, well, why were we not going in on a champions mall provisional?
Yeah.
When we won the championship in 95 in one of the classes, but this person's going in with something that they are carrying over from like 1991. No answer, you know, so just
is Beechridge. I mean, whatever. I mean, I worked there for 25, 30 years. Later on in the podcast, we'll get to your infamous meeting. I mean, from your vantage point, and I don't think it would be a unique one. Is it like almost like the mafia in a way where they're like, and that's not a leading question. You can either just say no and we can move on. But it seems to me from different stories, one of the biggest pieces of feedback that I've heard on the podcast this year is that a lot of the onion's been peeled back from what some of the drivers experienced and what some of the teams experienced that weren't necessarily talked about. But now, whether it's statute of limitations or fear of the repercussion of talking about it publicly, people are more open to speaking about their experience, or at least their version of the experience. And, you know, talking about some of the unwritten rules that went along with it. It almost seems like it's very mafia-ish at times. And I'm a guy that worked there, so maybe I was in the mafia and I didn't even know.
Well, you call it mafia. I call it, they all drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I compared it to, what was it, Jim Jones? Was it the
Davy
guy
Jones?
That, yeah, wasn't the guy that made everybody drink the Kool-Aid out on that island and they all drank it? I mean, it's your local home track.
Right.
So you want to do all the right things. You want to support. But it was almost like you had to respect because of fear.
Mm. Versus the mafia.
Yeah, because
you're going to get your knees broken.
Yeah, versus respect because you respect. It was just different.
And every local track has that. You've had experiences throughout the Northeast. Have you ever experienced anything like the Beech Ridge experience anywhere else?
No. I mean, I've had my ins and outs with Pass and Mayberry. You know what I mean?
How many lifetime bans do you have?
And I don't even know if they're lifetime bans.
No, they're not.
I'm just a race fan.
Yeah.
And I don't get all worked up over stuff. And I don't, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to get all worked up over stuff, I'd have a miserable life.
Yeah.
I just don't. I just want to go watch racing. If I don't, I don't. And, you know, I've been in it so long and I've done so much. And, you know, some of it is the misinformation when people are presented, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't do or I haven't done anything over the years to, you know, I'm definitely not retiring because of anything I've given back into racing or I've done into racing. I don't do it for the accolades. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think I've gotten over the years. I think I got a couple of,
how many plaques you have?
Plaques and a certificate and a couple of pat on the backs and a thank you or something. But
I'll stop you there. I don't mind interrupting you on this one because it's plaques are one thing. We started this podcast talking about what you do at LST, and that's making memories, and that's something you can't put on a plaque. I think your legacy overall is going to be the memories that you've afforded others to experience as families, as generations, as friends. You offer a facility that, fosters lifelong friendships, and I think that's worth its weight in gold right there.
Well, and it's funny because the TV show. And we haven't even touched on that.
No. I still want to know why you're number 87, because that's a story in its own right. I want the audience to know.
The 87, like, my first crew job was Bub Bilodeau. Mm. You know what I mean? And
how'd you and Bub meet, by the way?
So, Bub and his brother Rick parked next to Brick's dad, Larry, in the pits back in the early 80s and became friends. Everybody, you know, helps everybody.
Yeah.
And Bub's car ended up parking at our house, and the first year when he raced the number 87 Camaro, I wasn't old enough to go in the pits, but I would hang out, and, you know, I was newly getting my license, and, you know, and just
hanging out at the skating rink.
The skating rink or the shop. They'd have shop night. They'd all come over and work on their race cars, and the track was clay, and I'd listen to their war stories, and, you know, a couple of the guys, Charlie Tyler had a 66 or 64 Mustang, and Brent Benner had like a 68 Camaro, so they'd bring them over, and they were cool just to be around. And so then, you know, Bub was younger, Rick was a little older. I think he had already had it out of the family. And Bub and Terry was my first real girl crush. Older girl crush, you know what I mean? So, you always try to hang around. And
why were you hanging around Bub? Because of Terry.
But so then the next year they're like, you want to be part of the crew, you know? And I thought it was a cool thing, you know, I was like, oh yeah, I want to be part of the crew. I really didn't want to be part of the crew. You know, right. I'd go in the pits and I didn't know anything. And, you know, and then about halfway through the year, I'm like, this sucks. You know what I mean? So I'd go there for practice and I'd go in the grandstands and watch the races and hang out with the girls that were over there and stuff. And,
yeah.
But yeah, you know, and it just, you always followed Bob and you always, you know, did that. So then when it came time to come racing, you know, I was dating Leanne at the time and, you know, I put down a list of numbers and, you know, that I would choose to pick and, you know, and she put down a list of numbers and, you know, and I let her choose, you know, and she was the one that picked the 87, you know, because,
wow.
You know, and
did it have anything to do with Bob though?
Yeah, it was, you know, I liked it because of Bob and she liked it because it was the year she graduated, you know? So, yeah, so it was just, cool. It was one of those things. And we always kept contact with, you know, with Bob and, you know, and all that. And it was funny because I'll never forget the night that I won my first race we talked about.
Hmm.
You know, I took the lead and I checked out, but then I started looking in the mirror. And then you start getting nervous. Yeah. I'm going to do something wrong. At the end of the race, the guy was on my bumper because I let him do that. And
yeah.
I remember Bob coming to the scales to congratulate me. And the first thing he did was reach in and take my mirror and flip it up, you know, and he's like,
you don't need this anymore.
Don't do this. Don't do that. You almost cost yourself a race, you know? So no, it's just, you know, and it's so funny because getting to know Bob, you know, back then and watching his career progress, you felt like, you know, you were in the presence of a hero. You know what I mean? And that's one thing that the kids today, they don't have that because the drivers are so accessible. And so, you know, I remember sitting in the stands and winning junior fan club.
Mm.
And like, I'm going to get to go in the pits and I'm going to get to tell her that I want to go meet Homer Drew. I want to go, you know, those were big deals.
Yeah.
You know, meeting a driver.
And you were also one of thousands of kids there that week.
Yeah.
That necessarily doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. Now with the, you know, the former happy half hours and the autograph sessions and
bunny bus,
social medias and all that stuff. It's, I think it's in a way it's helped the sport, you know, because it has made guys more accessible and made them more, you know, I don't want to say it,
available,
the sport more friendly, but it's also made it, and I don't know what word I'm looking
for. It's taken away some of the mystique.
Yeah.
I'll put it that way. You know, it's, for example, how many, you know, I always liken things to music. How many interviews have you seen with Led Zeppelin? Right? Zero. Maybe one or two if you dig really deep on YouTube, because Led Zeppelin didn't do interviews back then. But there's a mystique around them. Yet every popular artist today is constantly on social media. And it's, A, what they need to do to stay in business because the business has changed. But it's also the land of diminishing returns when it comes to mystique. And I think that's what you're speaking of. You know, you put Bob on a pedestal because he was someone who wasn't accessible. And I think a lot of us who grew up in the time that we did felt the same way about our heroes. Whereas now you can direct message your heroes.
Yeah.
And they'll get back to you because they're super good people and they're family men too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I remember having a conversation with Dave Dion. And one of the things that he brings up is the rivalries, you know, and everybody's friends now. And he was telling me, he said, you know, I might say, you know, good job or congratulations after the race to somebody, but I'm not going to go down and drink a beer with them. That race paid $5,000 and you just took it from me.
Mm.
I wanted that 5,000.
Yep.
You took it from me. I'm not happy about it, you know, but not today.
Yeah.
You know, we're all, hey, you know, oh, you know.
Well, it depends. I mean, there are certain buttons that even I pushed this year that really, you know, and I've spoken to both parties. I think we know which one I'm talking about we're basically not trying to create rivalries. But when I see one and I know that it's genuine, that's what you want to highlight, knowing that the fans are going to decide what they think is right or wrong, you know. And it comes back to something we talked about with Lewis too. No one really, everybody wants to be the hero, few people want to be the villain, and nobody wants to be the court jester. Lewis Anderson was all three,
you know? Oh, yeah, no, by far.
Yeah, but you know, so yeah, you had that relationship with Bob. I wanted to actually get back to the story about the 1997 season, but one sub question as we're talking about Bob, how come he never drove for SP2?
Bob?
Yeah. How come he never drove for your pro stock program?
Well, he had his own successful program at that time.
I know, but it just seemed like it would work.
He didn't need us, and we didn't need him.
Okay.
And it was so funny. 1997. Hmm. So we are the two fastest cars of the season, Bub and Donnie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the Fowler car is back in third now at this point, right?
Yeah.
With Maeda driving.
With Maeda driving, right? We're not racing against each other at all. It would just never, but we're the two fastest cars, mm-hmm. okay? Bub's not having a great year, but he's winning races, but he's having a lot of mechanical failures. We're having a race. It's towards the end of the year, and Maeda's having a bad night. Booba's having a bad night. We made a change between the heat and the feature, and we're blistering fast. So we get on the radio. Paul Johnson's leading. I think, I don't know if Bub's second, Bobby Babb's third, Donnie's fourth. And we get on the radio per spot and says to Donnie, he says, listen, we're good. We're going to come out of here with a huge point lead tonight with like 3 weeks left to go in the season. Mm-hmm. Maeda's back in 20th. Booba's way back there. Just relax. We're all good. Just ride this out. Well, he wanted to beat Bub in the worst way, and this was the first time that the two of them were up front racing. You know, they might have been, Bub might have won a race, and we might have been fifth, and we might have been up front. We didn't want to race all
year. You guys are head-to-head.
Yeah, but we're gonna settle this out. The two best cars are going to be there. Just got to get rid of Johnson, get rid of Babb, and we're going. So they go into one and two, and Paul Johnson and Bub make a little contact. So when they do, you know, they bobble. Donnie's back in the throttle, turns Bub around. It wasn't intentional. But Bob Everybody. Libby, chief judge and bottle washer, whatever he was at the time, thinks it was intentional because there was contact throughout, you know, there was hated. So I'll never forget. Leanne's pregnant with Alicia, you know, 8.5 months pregnant. I'm headed for Bob Libby, right? Because they throw us off the track. Think we did it intentional. Mm-hmm. You know, we're racing for a championship. We're not doing that intentional. So I'm like, here we go. So I'm headed for Bob Libby. She thinks I'm going to knock this 80-year-old man out. I just want an explanation, right?
Right.
Here she is waddling down through the pits to try to get me, right? So we come back. We're all settled down, right? Cars wrecked. You know, we couldn't have gone anyway, right? So I'm just so frustrated, right? So frustrated. Like, why did you even put yourself in that position? You know, we had just on the radio had a conversation. We don't need
this
picture,
drama.
Big picture.
Yeah.
So I'll never forget. So I'm like, Donnie, why did we put ourselves in that position? You know, we didn't need to race for the win. You know, those guys are way at the back. Now the whole field's clustered. Now Maeda's back up in top 10, because a lot of cars went scattering, you know. And Donnie's father says, we come here to win races. I go, pal, anybody can come here and win races. I can give you a whole list of people who won races. There's a short list of guys that have won the championships in this late model division, you know. So it was at that point that I made my decision right then that I was making a driver change at the end of the year. Like, we're not in this together. You know what I mean? We set out at a common goal to win this championship, you know?
And then other things took over.
Yeah. Like, so yeah.
Well, even though it's a partnership, it's still your car.
Yeah.
Right? So you're the boss, and Donnie, in a sense, is a employee type role.
Yeah.
Right. So it's an employee who's a star employee and, you know, your best earner, but still, you know, not necessarily going with the company line. What the company wants to accomplish.
What was best for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, Donnie's going to, you know, if we can win the championship, he's going to be the headline attraction at the banquet to stop the Fowler, Johnson, Maeda, Randall.
Yeah.
You know, that's the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, probably, and it was so funny because I was at the banquet the other night when Bobby Babb got inducted, and we came close in 98 because we put little Mikey Jr. in our car, and we led the points from week 3 to week 17 and lost the championship to Bobby Babb by 6 points, you know. And
On the Mike Maeda podcast, he said that racing Mike Jr. was his toughest competitor. Do you have any stories from that year of those two?
Yeah, you know, probably in 98, had Mike Maeda Sr. not put as much effort into his home program, because when Mike Jr. left the Maeda family racing to come race for my team, you know.
How much of a big step was that?
Well, that was huge.
I mean,
you know, when you've raced for the family.
Yeah.
And now you're...
It's Kyle Petty leaving Petty Enterprises.
You're coming to race for Steve Perry, you know?
You're Felix Sabatis, basically.
Yeah. He's coming to race for me. And they were all behind it. You know, Neil was a big supporter, Big Lou. But Mike couldn't not race. You know what I mean? I think if Mike had done what his original intent was to support us, I think we'd have been better off, because, you know, he wasn't not supporting us, but
he had his own deal.
You know what I mean? Okay. So he wasn't there for Mikey. I didn't need him, but I think Mikey could have used him, you know, when he got out of the car, have him standing next to him, because we weren't, you know, we separated enough. We weren't pitted next to each other. We weren't, you know what I mean? Because he had his own deal, you know. But it would have been nice if he would have been able to, you know, Mikey comes in on the pad, the old man gets out, because he got to watch him practice, got to watch his heat, got to watch his
feature. There wasn't a lot of synergy then.
Yeah.
And I think maybe if you were only on the other side of the track at that point, and this is before social media, before everybody knows everything about everybody at every single moment, you know, there's that mystique of what happens on the other side of the racetrack. And, you know, you can certainly draw your own conclusions and make your own perception that, you know, the father and the son, even though they're racing for different teams, they're still together and they're still working and they're, you know, they're a unit. And that wasn't the case.
Yeah. And we weren't against each other, but, you know, he was doing his thing. We were doing our thing. And then, and I think it, had he been there for little Mikey, you know, like I said, we didn't need him. We had our own deal going, but just as that driver coach, you know what I mean?
And who were some of your sponsors at this point?
So I've always been fortunate. I mean, we had the Portland Pirates.
I thought that was the Pirates. You know? How'd you get the Pirates?
A friend of Mikey's. Mikey had Primestar, you know, at one point. We had them with Donnie. And then, you know, I had TV Guide at one point. You know, we've been fortunate enough.
How much money is coming in with these sponsorships in the 90s?
You know, at that point, $5,000 is a big sponsor. You know what I mean? You know, and some of it with the Pirates, it wasn't a lot of money with them, but the notoriety that they brought attracted other sponsors to want to be a part of the program.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just nothing attracts a crowd like a crowd.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sure you displayed that car at the Civic Center.
Yeah, we were center ice of a game, you know what I mean? The guys wearing the polos and, you know, and having it.
The perception that there's a $20,000 sponsorship that isn't really a $20,000. Same thing with Coup de Marche and the Course sponsorship, which we learned about at the beginning of this year. There wasn't a lot of money tied with that, but everybody thought there was.
Yeah, so, you know what I mean? And then trying to do the extra for the sponsors and those type of things. So, you know, and it was, and like I said, part of it, I think, as you're racing, you know, you're trying to do all the best things. You're trying to get the most success you can. You know, so 97, 98, two tastes of what I call, you know, so close to that championship, you know, just wanting that, you know, top level championship and being so close both years. And 99, it was, I don't know why I made the decision to do what I did, but, you know, when we talk egos and dumb moves, I'm like, why don't we field a car at Beech Ridge and a car at Oxford? Like, unheard of, right?
Right.
I'm just a working stiff.
And what are you doing at this point for a vocation?
I'm working at the mill.
Still at the mill.
Yeah. And they were getting ready to have the big shutdown. So halfway through building, refurbishing one car and building a new car for Robbie Harrison to go to Oxford, the mill has a big shutdown, and you know, I lose my job.
Do they shut down because of the environment?
No, they shut down because just business sense. They move part of the production to another part of the country, and you know, so now I'm going to go race Oxford, and I'm going to go race Beechridge. So I got two what we call super late model teams running.
Yeah, on Saturday night. Was it Friday night they ran?
They both ran Saturdays.
Okay.
So I, you know, one, you know, the team at Beechridge is basically fully funded between the Mayetta sponsorship and the Pirate sponsorship, and you know, so that one's not a problem. The one at Oxford's fully funded out of my pocket. They're in a sponsor on it. Wow. You know, and
why not pull the plug on that?
We did halfway through the year. We were running terrible, and it was the year that Jeff Taylor and Tracy Gordon had left. So they went from racing 18 cars a week to 35 cars a week because everybody felt like they had a chance then. And we were terrible. The car was terrible. We were terrible. It was just.
And Robbie was new at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, you know, it was.
20-year-old kid.
Yeah, he had raced the 1 or 2 years for Ricky Drew and the team at Beechridge. So, you know, he was a hot commodity at that point. And, you know, but it just didn't work out. You know, he didn't gel with the team. You know, not saying his fault, not saying our fault, just didn't gel. Yeah. You know, he was used to being the guy calling the shots. Now he's coming to a team that's used to being the team that calls the shots, you know? So we pulled back. And I literally, the next year, we kind of took the year off. We kind of, you know.
2000.
Did our own thing. We bounced around a little bit, did some one-off races. Still went to the 250 as a team. Kept our streak going of always qualifying for the 250.
And who did you take every year on this? Because it wasn't Donnie. After Donnie, what happened?
We went with 2 years with Donnie. Went 2 years with Mike Jr. Mm-hmm. 2000, we went with Scott Mulkern. 2001, I went with David Pinkham. And then in 2002, I went with Bubba Pelton.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a strong class class of drivers.
Yep. Yeah. And then, so we literally, 7 years in a row, we went to the 250.
Are any of these renter rides?
Nope. They're all guys that we were, you know.
So you would make the call and say, I want you in the car?
Well, they were our drivers that we raced weekly at Beechridge with, except just, Mulkern. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, just the deals all together. I think, you know, to explain to a modern day fan that you don't have to buy the ride is still kind of a foreign concept to someone who's only been around for 4 or 5 years. This was all legit. You were like, they brought zero money. You wanted them in the car, and that's the plan that you made for the year.
Yeah. You know, and then they might have a sponsor, or they'd bring a sponsor, or they'd try to help out. But, you know, we'd talk as a group, you know, me and Spanky and Perv, and, you know, and you know, we were a team, you know, and like I said, they called the shots. I would find the money, you know, I would do whatever it took to keep us racing, you know.
What's your best finish in the 250? I mean, of that era? Mm-hmm. Before the, well, we'll get to that later.
I don't even know. Yeah. Maybe a
top 10.
18th, 19th. Yeah. I mean, in 97, I will tell you this. It's the only time I ever counted the money.
Mm.
There was 50 laps to go. We were running fourth with Donnie. There was only 8 cars on the lead lap. We were better than 5 of them. We were running fourth. The only 3 that I didn't know what we had for anything for was Tracy Gordon, Gary Drew, and Mike Rowe. But the one thing that we had, we still had 2 tires left in the pits. And we were as good as them 3 up front. We didn't know if we were better, but we were as good.
Mm-hmm.
And I counted the money. Fourth paid $6,500. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is unbelievable. Like, at worst, we're going to finish this fourth. 5 laps later, a lap car spins on the backstretch. Donnie's got nowhere to go and T-bones him. And the $6,500 check went with us. Now is a $7,500 bill. Only time I ever counted the money.
Yeah.
It was so depressing.
Awesome stuff from Steve in stage number 1. Yes, there is a stage number 2. And in stage number 2, we get into more Steve.
I call her up. I said, I'm going to go to Halifax this weekend and go racing with Mike Rowe. She says, no, we got plans this weekend. We got a sitter, the kids. And mm-hmm. I said, yeah, but I got a chance. Mike Rowe, can't we do that another weekend? She goes, no, we got we made plans. You know, this is what we're going to do. I said, yeah, but Mike Rowe. But- I said, and she's like, no. I said, listen, you know that new Gucci watch you want? She goes, yeah. I go, I'll get it for you if I can just go to Halifax. She goes, you get it for me before you leave?
That's next time out on Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin. Thank you for your support.